At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not exactly the Big Bang, but we have a better idea today of how the credit squeeze started with a company called New Century Financial and some accountants who really should have known better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this 27th of March. Today is Thursday. We've known for a while now that the seeds of the subprime meltdown and the credit crunch got started with New Century. At one point, it was the second largest subprime mortgage company in this country. It collapsed almost exactly a year ago, April 2nd, 2007, if you want the date. And now an investigation into what went wrong has shed new light on how the wheels fell off the economy. There's plenty of blame to go around, including all the way to the people watching the books, New Century's auditors, KPMG. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has read that report. Hiya, John.
Hello, Kai.
Give us the nickel tour here. What did this report say?
Well, you know, it's really comprehensive. It's nearly 600 pages. It was ordered by the bankruptcy court that's trying to sort out which creditors get a share of the company's remaining assets. The investigation showed that New Century manipulated its accounting to keep troubled loans off its books, which means even though the company was losing money and borrowers were beginning to default on their payments, the accounting showed a profit in 2006 that wasn't really there. And when the truth began to come out the following year, Wall Street investors and hedge funds started demanding that New Century buy back its subprime loans. New Century couldn't do that and went bankrupt.
All right, I got one word for you, John, maybe a couple here. The report also mentions KPMG, the company's auditors. In that light, do the words Enron and Sarbanes-Oxley mean nothing to these people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember back in 2001 when Enron was caught with all sorts of sleight-of-hand accounting? Its auditor, Arthur Anderson, was convicted of helping out. The investigator into this New Century case even points to similarities with the Enron situation. He found some emails where New Century executives were basically browbeating their auditors into signing off on the questionable accounting methods. And KPMG essentially went along with the bookkeeping that its client, New Century, was insisting on, which is exactly what the post-Enron reforms like Sarbanes-Oxley were designed to put a stop to. Executives from both the company and the auditor must now take personal responsibility. There was another Sarbanes-Oxley reform that might be relevant here, too. It requires that the lead auditor of a company be rotated every 5 years. The worry is that an auditor that's on the job for too long gets too close to the company and even becomes a part of the team. And that seems to have been the case between KPMG and New Century's executives. Some reformers I talked to today say, you know, maybe that rotation should be more frequent, maybe every 2 or 3 years.
You know, Arthur Anderson, as it existed before Enron, no longer exists in that same form. Is there any fear that the same thing might happen to KPMG and we'd be down yet another big accounting firm?
You know, there are plenty of lawsuits from New Century's bankruptcy, and you got to figure that with this investigation's findings, KPMG is going to have a much tougher time extricating itself from liability in New Century's demise.
One more question for you, John, before I let you go. Deloitte & Touche is the accounting firm for Bear Stearns. PricewaterhouseCoopers handles the books for J.P. Morgan. I ask because how do we know there's not more coming here?
Yeah, we don't. If the auditors aren't raising any red flags, we don't really know ahead of the actual trouble, which is why reformers were trying to force some personal responsibility onto these executives and the auditors. Presumably, that responsibility will add to the criminal liability that's faced by both of them when they try to hide the company's debts.
And we'll know it when that next shoe drops, right?
Right.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale on the accounting beat for us in Washington, D.C. Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
Ben Bernanke's wish list for how to fix what ails the economy is probably pretty long, but somewhere right near the top would be to have Wall Street banks start lending again. The Federal Reserve figures that if they begin to spread the wealth to each other and to other investors, then slowly but surely the credit markets will loosen up. Making that happen, though, takes confidence and it takes money. The Fed tried to take care of the second half of that equation today by pumping another $75 billion into those frozen credit markets. As to the first part, the trust, we're going to have to see about that as Marketplace's Joe Barshea reports now from New York.
The Fed's move amounts to a big swap with Wall Street. The Fed exchanged $75 billion of Treasury notes for unpopular mortgage securities owned by the big investment banks. Lou Crandall is chief economist at Reitz and ICAP.
Market participants get a highly liquid security that everyone has confidence in. The Fed temporarily warehouses the less liquid securities.
Crandall says the Fed dreamt up this fix a few weeks ago when the investment banks stopped lending to some of their customers. That included hedge funds who invested in mortgage-backed securities.
They were having to liquidate. And that resulted in a huge glut of mortgages on the market and a backup in interest rates for the few would-be home buyers who are still out there.
Crandall says the Fed wants to encourage investment banks to lend to their customers again, and it hopes that will stop mortgage securities from free-falling. Vincent Reinhardt is a monetary policy expert at the American Enterprise Institute. He welcomes this liquidity injection and says it might have helped Bear Stearns stay in business if it had come sooner. Reinhardt says the Fed has been looking for ways to ease the credit crisis since the end of last year.
Add them all up, these programs total $400 billion. That's almost half the Federal Reserve's balance sheet.
Reinhardt says these new programs are band-aids, not solutions. He says if the mortgage market isn't fixed, Wall Street will need to find fresh capital from outside investors. In New York, I'm Jill Barshea from Marketplace.
It's not like the oil markets needed any more stress, but they got it all the same today. Insurgents in Iraq blew up a crucial pipeline down near Basra. That's in the southern part of the country where most of Iraq's oil deposits are. Crude prices took a corresponding jump up above $108 a barrel before closing at about $107.50 in New York. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has this look at pricing, cause and effect.
The attacks could reduce southern Iraq's oil exports by at least a third. In the past, pipeline disruptions have been fixed relatively quickly, but there's a larger concern. Severin Borenstein is director of the University of California Energy Institute. He says escalating violence could disrupt Iraq's oil industry at a time when it's benefiting from high oil prices.
Iraq is taking in a lot of revenue from the oil industry right now. Having their oil industry taken offline, even 50% of it, would be a pretty major hit to their economy.
If things get worse for Iraq, Borenstein says the ripples could affect the global market, but not everyone agrees.
In today's oil market, it is totally insignificant.
That's energy economist Philip Verleger. He says Saudi Arabia has been pumping extra crude to compensate for any Iraqi shortfall, and there's plenty of oil on the world market.
The supply is there, it's just the way it's priced, they can't afford to buy it. So we could take Iraq out of the market for 6 months, and nobody'd notice the difference.
He says the soaring price of oil can be blamed on fear, but not the fear of violence abroad. Instead, it's a fear of inflation at home. As the Federal Reserve has cut interest rates, Verleger says investors have been seeking safe haven in commodities, like oil. And if inflation does creep into the economy, more investors could warm to oil commodities. If Iraq can stem the violence and revive its oil industry, it stands to profit. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Corporate profits and economic indicators moved the markets today, moved them down. We'll have the details when we do the number. You probably already know this, but your computer is watching you. Marketers love the web. It lets them track your every click and meet you there. Today, one online pioneer rolled out a way to make following you online even easier. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has more on the latest from YouTube.
Say you want to be a rock star. In this digital age, you've probably got a video clip up in a bunch of places, including YouTube. Now, thanks to a new free measurement service YouTube introduced today, you'll be able to find out something about who's watching your video, when they watch it, and where they live.
You can look at individual states where your videos are doing well, where they can actually, you know, theoretically figure out where they should tour and where they shouldn't bother.
That's Mike Shields of Media Week. He says it's not just garage bands who'll want to use what YouTube's calling insight. Programmers could gauge reaction to new shows and movies. Marketers could figure out where to sell their products.
There's a lot of potential implications for advertisers to test different creatives. You know, they could actually figure out which creative to put on television at one point.
A kind of virtual focus group with 72 million of your closest friends. Joe Turow of the Annenberg School of Communication says YouTube's insight has a potentially larger benefit. It could provide the answer to a burning question.
People have been trying to puzzle out how user-generated content, how they could make the kind of money that those companies feel they deserve to make.
That's what Google has been asking itself since it laid out $1.6 billion in stock to buy YouTube 18 months ago. Other user-generated media sites have been trying to figure out how to make money, too.
The amount of money that comes through those sites is not nearly like the amount of money that comes through search engines.
Maybe with insight, now they'll have found a way to change the equation. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
College basketball's Sweet 16 is upon us, which means we're about halfway through March Madness. There are a couple of givens about the Hoops tournament every year. There will be upsets, as there have been this time. There will also be blowouts. And if you catch enough games, you're going to be humming college fight songs all the way into April. Annoying as that is, those songs aren't all team spirit and nostalgia, though, as Tanya Ott reports from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama.
Scott Clayton has a nightmare, and it sounds like this.
Sometimes you get some crazy people that will come in here and decide they want to push them all at the same time. So it kind of sounds like a swarm of bees is just going throughout the store, and it makes you just want to, your head explode sometimes.
Clayton manages Bama Fever Tiger Pride, a school spirit shop in Birmingham, where you can buy everything from bottle openers to pet toys, embedded with microchips that play the fight songs for the University of Alabama and Auburn University. It got so bad, Clayton resorted to moving most musical items behind the sales counter.
So that way they have to ask us if they want it.
And boy, do they want it, to the tune of $100,000 a year. That's what Manhattan-based music publisher Carlin America makes on fight songs. Carlin bought the rights to more than 100 such songs when it acquired another publishing company in 1999.
At the time, it was a pretty sleepy catalog with which not much had been done.
But the market woke up, says Carlin president Caroline Beanstalk, thanks to sports video games and cell phone ringtones.
And that's always the hope, is that you unearth a jewel that turns out to be valuable to you.
The fight songs in that catalog may have been Carlin's diamond in the rough, but they're useless to schools like Alabama and Auburn. They make money by licensing the logos on these tchotchkes, but they don't make a penny from the music. Susan Smith is Auburn's licensing director.
All your tailgating items in here.
She wades through an office packed with orange and blue stuff. The school makes more than $2 million a year licensing everything from barbecues to Christmas ornaments. But it missed the chance to cash in on its fight song back in the 50s. That's when a loyal alumnus commissioned a New York songwriting team.
He paid for the song to be produced, and he made an assumption, apparently, that it was his. Back then, you didn't think about having to have an attorney to sign off on everything you did.
In fact, the songwriters retained the rights. They then sold the rights on to a music publisher. 50 years later, Carlin America bought them. Again, Carl in America's Caroline Beanstalk.
It has to be remembered that for the sake of the writer, the opportunity to earn money from the use of their composition is really what they're doing it for. I doubt that the composer felt that there was unfairness associated with this. In fact, they were all in favor of having it be represented professionally.
Everything is fair game for those composers' work these days. Doorbells, car horns, even toilet seats, they're all singing college songs and generating lots of money. A good reason for schools to fight, fight, fight to hold on to their song rights. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
Open Skies gets a cool reception.
Just to say to the Americans, don't expect to enjoy the experience of coming through Heathrow.
That's coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. A lackluster but completely expected GDP report and a slumping tech sector pushed stocks downward today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial stumbled 0.9%, 120 points, to close at 12,302. The Nasdaq plunged 1.8%, 43 points, closed at 2280. The S&P 500 slipped 1%, 13 points, met the bell at 1327. Clear Channel bounced back today. A Texas judge ordered banks not to interfere with a private equity buyout of the media company, and its shares cranked up 10%. Oracle's sales fell short of analysts' expectations, and so the software maker fell more than 7% in trading today. Google clicked down 3% on news that ads on the web giant site are generating fewer hits. That's a bad thing for a company that makes its money on ads. Markets in Europe closed higher today. Back home, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org.
Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for February. President Bush meets with the Prime Minister of Australia at the White House. And the 47 member states of the UN Human Rights Council conclude a four-week session in Geneva. One of the resolutions passed calls for the protection of human rights while fighting terrorism. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Don't look now, but there's something happening in the world of car insurance. Premiums are going down, so the competition for customers is heating up. Some of the biggest companies are looking to the age group that's typically the riskiest and most expensive to insure. They're offering discounts to young drivers and to their parents. Jeremy Hobson has more.
You don't have to buy your kid a car on her 16th birthday to notice a difference in your account balance. Just ask the Dwinell family of Montpelier, Vermont, who have to pay more than $1,000 a year for car insurance. There are two kids of driving age, but the mom, Jane Dwinell, says right now only one is on the insurance bill.
Actually, the 17-year-old has refused to get his driver's license because we make them pay their share of car insurance, and he didn't want to have to pay.
Now, the industry knows it's expensive to insure young drivers, and for good reason. They get in more accidents. But with more competition, say for cars and drops in theft and fraud, premium rates are flattening across the board. So teens are looking better to insurers.
Insurance companies really are looking to build their book of business, but also they're looking for the best risks in terms of drivers.
Gene Salvatore is with the Insurance Information Institute, an industry group. She says many of the deep discounts offered to young drivers come with rules, from increased driving lessons to this idea from Safeco.
After you receive a Teensurance kit, a small GPS system is placed under the dash of the car.
If you're willing to track your kids or take other safety measures, the rewards can be substantial, from 5% all the way up to 50% on some premiums. And for the insurance companies is the potential for customers who could stick around for decades. That adds up, even for an industry that already pulls in more than $160 billion worth of premiums each year. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Boeing lost another big tanker contract today. London announced it's chosen the European consortium behind Airbus to replace refueling planes for the Royal Air Force. Chicago-based Boeing is still steaming over the Pentagon's decision to pass on its bid to build 179 new tankers for the U.S. Air Force. The contract went instead to Airbus and Northrop Grumman, a decision that has been met by no small amount of congressional flag-waving. Commentator Benjamin Barber says that in today's global economy, the idea that Boeing is American while Airbus is foreign is simply antiquated.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Boeing, the favorite to win the Pentagon's new $35 billion contract for a refueling tanker, was edged out by a foreign company, Airbus parent EADS. Working with Northrop Grumman, hey, isn't Grumman American? EADS promised a bigger, better tanker and showcased a new fueling boom. Meanwhile, Boeing didn't build a boom prototype and couldn't promise the 49 tankers EADS said would be ready by 2013. But it did remind the Pentagon, wink, wink, it was American, and American jobs depended on the contract. The Pentagon didn't bite. It awarded the contract to the bidder with the best airplane. Politicians like Senator Patty Murray were irate. We really have to wake up the country. We are at risk of losing a major part of our aerospace industry to the Europeans forever. Only it ain't so. It's Dubai ports all over again. We learned then that port security planning is handled by global firms, whether based in Dubai or London. Just like all American Chevys are built in Mexico with the majority of foreign parts, while foreign Toyotas are built in the U.S. with more American parts. Likewise, Boeing's American tanker promises 85% American parts and supports 44,000 American jobs. But guess what? The Airbus airplane has 60% American parts, creates 44,000 American jobs, and has GE engines. Pandering politicians will continue to shout, "Buy American." But the rest of us need to figure out how to oversee and regulate the global economy, in which both Boeing and Airbus are global, not American players. And if Boeing wants Pentagon contracts, it should stop playing the Patriot card and start making better products.
Benjamin Barber is with the New York think tank Demos. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. American Airlines has company in the maintenance hangar. Delta announced today it's going to cancel almost 300 flights, just like American did yesterday. The two carriers are inspecting wiring at the suggestion of the Federal Aviation Administration. There is some airline news, though, that you might actually want to hear. This weekend, a new open skies agreement between Europe and the U.S. goes into effect. It'll let all carriers fly the lucrative transatlantic routes, not just a select few airlines being allowed to land at a couple of European airports. Today, Heathrow, outside London, took the wraps off a brand-new terminal to handle all the extra passengers that route's going to bring. But Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports they might not be welcomed with open arms.
So today, it gives me great pleasure to open Terminal 5, this 21st century gateway to Britain.
That's the Queen giving her blessing to Heathrow's gleaming and spacious new terminal. The $9 billion facility opens for business today. It's expected to handle 30 million passengers a year and cut check-in times to just 10 minutes. British Airways boss Willie Walsh is cooing with delight.
It is fantastic. I think people will be genuinely wowed when they get an opportunity to come through Terminal 5.
But they'll only get that opportunity if they fly British Airways. Passengers on all the American carriers won't see the inside of the new facility. Many of them are likely to wind up in Heathrow's most notorious terminal.
We're now in Terminal 3, which is the major international terminal of Heathrow.
Michael Riley is a retired businessman and anti-Heathrow campaigner. He's against any further expansion of the airport. He says it's already too big and too busy. He's eager to point out the hassle awaiting American passengers using Terminal 3.
Just to say to the Americans, don't expect to enjoy the experience of coming through Heathrow.
Why not? I mean, what are they going to find when they come here?
Because it's full. Basically, it's full.
The airport is already so congested it can take 3 hours to check in and get through security. Riley says open skies, which could bring tens of thousands more American passengers across the Atlantic, will only make matters worse.
All it will do is just to put a gallon into a pint pot.
Heathrow says the airport must expand even further to cope with open skies. But 16 local authorities in London, the mayor, several national newspapers and half a dozen protest groups say no, no more expansion. They argue the airport's in the wrong place, in the middle of a heavily built-up area. 2 million residents suffer from the noise. Margaret Thorburn lives 4 miles from Heathrow.
There's one every minute at least. And we have this one after the other for half the day at the moment. Here we go, here comes another one.
Living close to an airport, you can't really complain about aircraft noise. Aircraft noise is inevitable, isn't it?
It's the sheer relentlessness of it. It's the fact that they just don't let up. And here comes another one.
You're not keen on this open skies agreement then, which looks as if it's going to bring a lot more air traffic over your home.
I'm afraid I'm not. I understand that there's something important business-wise. I think I'll have to stop again, I'm afraid.
Thorburn and other protesters are calling for Heathrow traffic to be capped and for a new London airport to be built well away from where people live. But Heathrow's expansion seems unstoppable, whether Londoners like it or not. Plans are afoot for a third runway. Heathrow is set to remain America's top destination in Europe. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Here's the unanticipated and perhaps unwelcome epilogue to Stephen's story. If you're flying into Terminal 5 at Heathrow anytime soon, you might want to limit yourself to carry-on bags. The baggage handling system crashed today. Dozens of flights were canceled.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today with apologies in advance to Elvis Presley. Viva Viagra! Yes, that was Viva Viagra from an ad that aired last year. The little blue pill was approved by the FDA 10 years ago today. Since then, 35 million men around the world have used it. Sales have slipped, though. There's competition now from Cialis and Levitra. But Pfizer did still make almost $2 billion on it last year. And a quick note about yesterday's show before we go. We mentioned a link to a video game called Mind Habits that a lot of you tried without success. Seems we overwhelmed their website, but we are told it does work, so just keep on plugging. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow gave up 120 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq trickled down 43 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 sank 13 points, 1% right there on the nose. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, throwing light on shady deals in Louisiana.
We don't want to have to hire somebody's brother-in-law. We don't want to have to know the right person to do business. Who you know should not be more important than what you know when it comes to doing business in Louisiana.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.